Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. And you'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which are at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will probably be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I hope you had a good and happy birthday yesterday.
Well, thank you very much. I had a very nice birthday. We really did the major celebrating on that for my birthday over the weekend. But I did put up on my Facebook page yesterday that I was pleased to announce that I'd made it halfway to 96, and that drew some attention. People seemed to respond to that. I don't like giving my age away. You know, I wouldn't feel comfortable about, you know, coming right out and saying how old I am. But you know, I feel, give people a math problem, let them work on it a while, let them kind of work through it, and.
Well, you could say you're a tenth of the way to 480, you know.
Now, that's hard math, right? I could have gotten really complicated like that. But the best compliment I received on my birthday was one of my friends left a comment under that. I said that I've made it halfway to 96. And he wrote, Phil, you don't look a day over halfway to 80. So, I thought that was.
That's very nice in a weird kind of way.
that worked
in a way that we would appreciate, you know.
That worked for me. Well, listen, we should introduce our guest. We don't have to stand on ceremony with this guest. We're very pleased to welcome Brian Wong back to Fast Forward Radio. Brian is, of course, the Director of Research for the Lifeboat Foundation. He has been a lecturer with Singularity University, and, of course, he is the mastermind behind nextbigfuture.com, one of the finest blogs out there. If you're not reading it, you need to start reading it. Brian, welcome back to Fast Forward Radio.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. And I was just saying right before before the music started to play, we actually had you on last week because we played our interview with you from the Singularity Summit. So we were talking about energy and some related topics. And what I was going to say to you then was that keeps you pretty even with PJ Manny, who was also on the show. She was on live, but you were there recording. And I think we've been
virtually.
Yeah, you were virtually there. Yeah, and yeah. You know, we're all about the virtual thing, anyhow. So that's
yeah.
But I don't know, Stephen. Did we ever figure out who's been on more, Brian or PJ?
Well, at one point, Brian got out ahead by about one show, but you know, the last time I figured it up, Phil, was probably about a year or so ago, and
oh,
so
okay.
You know, I guess we're just going to have to go back in the archive and count it up again because, well, anyway, it's fun having both PJ and Brian on, and so you know, regardless of who wins, we win, right?
That's the thing. I want to keep them competing because then they keep coming back on the show.
That's right.
That's the beauty of it. So, Brian, we got a number of things we want to get into with. That's too many prepositions for me. I'm sorry. Things we want to get into with you. That's right. This evening, but
yeah.
I think we want to start by talking about this Techonomy conference that you had some role in. So tell us a little bit about what that event was. I understand it was about 3 weeks, about a month ago now.
The beginning of August.
In Nevada.
Yeah, so it was. Yeah, it was in Tahoe, Lake Tahoe, and basically that it's a new conference that was put together by three ex Forbes editors, but with a lot of backing and direction from Bill Joy. And I think it may have had some, you know, inspiration from perhaps, you know, some other conferences, like perhaps the TED conferences or those kind of things. It had a lot of, it had some overlap in a few of the presenters. You know, there were presenters from, you know, certain technology and other areas, but also a lot of just straight-up wealthy people. You know, you had Bill Gates there, you had Eric Schmidt, you had, you know, top guys from Citibank and that kind of thing. It's basically like we had the top-tier billionaires, you know, your Bill Gates and your Larry Page and from Amazon, Jeff Bezos. And then where you have, like, you know, your powerhouse VCs and stuff, and then they're practically like the, you know, second-level money people in that kind of mix. So it's kind of interesting where normally they'd be kind of like the richest guy in the room. So they had a lot of wealthy people, movers and shakers and stuff, and then whoever they felt like having there to talk. And it was kind of, you know, if you had any kind of, anybody was kind of like, oh, you know, it's all the elite wealthy people there who talk about, you know, ruling the world kind of thing. But it was more benign than that. It was that they were trying to figure out how to have technology and economics work together it is to change the world, but in a positive way. You know, they're thinking about how to help, solve big problems in terms of, like, poverty, global challenges, and how to deal with rapid mass technology and that kind of thing. So they're thinking about things similar to Singularity Institute kind of thing, Singularity University, in terms of, like, how to help the billion people over 10 years kind of goal. But, you know, in a less, you know, they're talking about, you know, like one conference, one an hour-long talk might be on the future of currency, you know, future money, or reinventing productivity. So it was like these massive topics they would talk about for an hour. So
right.
How detailed can you be? But you had, you know, like that reinventing money thing, you'd have, you know, someone from Visa, someone from Citi, someone from PayPal, someone from a new thing called Zong, which is about trying to create a new currency kind of way to get money for, you know, startups or middle-tier companies. So you have the big play topic, then you have, you know, power hitters who are talking about how they might do it.
Yeah, when you talk about those kinds of topics, those do sound very Singularity University or Singularity Summit friendly, or like the kinds of things we might have gotten into at Convergence 08 or at a Foresight Week. But what's interesting here is this is not the traditional audience for that kind of event, and not the traditional set of participants necessarily. It sounds, you know, obviously there's some overlap here. But
right.
How did you become involved, and what was your role?
So one of the three four editors, of which it was David Kirkpatrick, Peter Petri, Brent Slender. Brent apparently has been a fan of my website for about a year and a half. So so that's how come I got invited. But basically there were six designated bloggers who got brought in to cover it, you know, with a new media spin. But they, you know, along with MSNBC and, you know, a bunch of regular media were there. But in terms of, you know, the blogosphere, I was one of six representatives from the blogosphere there.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And let's just talk a little bit about what they say about themselves. I put the definition of techonomy up on the blog. I'm going to read this, and then I'm going to read just a little bit from the manifesto here, and I'd like the three of us to talk about this a little bit. So here's the philosophy. It says, techonomy, organized activities related to the invention, development, production, distribution, and consumption of technology-enhanced goods and services that a society uses to address the problem of scarcity and to enhance the quality of life. Stephen, you with us so far?
Yeah, I am.
Works for you so far? Okay. I'm reading through this. I'm going, okay, I like this. Okay. So let's read a little more. Techonomy draws its inspiration from the creative capitalism of Bill Gates The Echo Pragmatism of Stuart Brand, The Big History of David Christian, and Bill Joy's recent work on the economics of large-scale innovation. Each thinker in his own way points to a new humanism founded on the old notion that invention is what we do as a species. Seems like we've said something like that around here from time to time. It is human nature to combine technology and economy to solve problems. To do so is both an opportunity and a responsibility. It's who we are and the only way we're going to get to any solutions. So here's what techonomy promotes: a rational, optimistic, forward-looking, technically savvy work ethic that celebrates technological achievement, human ingenuity, and sustainable living. Techonomic thinking is suited not only to inventors and entrepreneurs, but also to people who work in major forward-looking institutions, Google, say, or McKinsey, or the Department of Defense, or the Federal Reserve. Indeed, the scale and scope of the problems we confront makes them too big for individualism or entrepreneurship alone. They require fast action on a very large scale. Techonomy embodies an engineering can-do spirit and emphasizes solutions that scale up. Yet as a mindset, it is equally suitable and essential for even the smallest enterprises. So, there's lots more, but I won't read the whole thing. Just first off, Brian, how well do you feel that event syncs up with the philosophy? Did the talks that you heard, the people that were expressing ideas, were they pretty much in line with this kind of outline? I realize they're kind of painting in broad strokes.
I think mostly it was in line. It was a lot of the engineering technocrat kind of approach, but with technocrat with the within the constraints or recognizing the necessity for things like having a business plan or some kind of economic rationalism, right? So it was kind of focusing on how to engineer a way to make it work, but with an MBA kind of making sure that the plan could function. So that was broadly most of the time what was there. But then there was also some more straight up pure green environmentalism. There were people who were pushing those kinds of agendas as well there. So you'd have that kind of mix. But the vast majority were practical business people, but they were also people who had an engineering bent. You'd have Dean Kamen there, who has had and mentioned had a segue and stuff in his adventure. So you have that kind of thing, but they were cognizant of they had to make the business, the economics of whatever you're trying to do work in order to have it kind of sustainable.
Yeah, it's very interesting to me that they seem to be straddling a couple of different threads here. They seem to be recognizing that this is it's complex staking out a position on this. And just because you mentioned the word technocracy, I want to read this last paragraph because I think this is interesting too. They say techonomy is not technocracy. It embraces free markets. They are a powerful accelerant of progress. Yet, given the global scale of the problems we face, from the effects of climate change to the implications of having the human population entirely connected by cell phones and mobile computers in the near future, market forces and market solutions are insufficient. We believe that every business, government, and organization should embrace techonomical – it takes a minute to get used to these words – techonomical innovation as central to its structure and future. So here's what
– they are trying to coin new terms. They are trying to, brand it in a way. It's like you have Google as a verb kind of thing.
Right.
They're trying to make techonomy, technomical, these kind of things as new terms in language. So they're trying to, with a marketing spin, they're trying to do that. And they're also, in terms of this philosophy manifesto thing, they're trying to do it more than, dry white paper. They're trying to, create some kind of grassroots technological engineering, but also, top and bottom, right? They have the top end with their, money and influence, and then they have, they're trying to get people engage the students. They're trying to engage other people, so they're trying to go top and bottom with this with their approaches.
That's what really gets my attention about this. And it was interesting you mentioned that it's the rich guys getting together, but not to talk about how to take over the world. Of course, guys like us, we don't get invited to those meetings, right? That's
yeah.
We'd never get that invitation if what? They have them. I don't know.
What are we going to do this week, Phil?
Trying
to take over the world. Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, it had to be said. The point I was going to make was it's interesting that you mentioned that top down and bottom up, because that's what I kept reading as I was reading through the philosophy. There was you can't do this completely one way or the other. That seems to be the very pragmatic position that's staked out here, and I feel that that is an extremely insightful position to take. Especially because I know that neither side of our current, like, partisan political split in this country wants to hear that, right? Either the world needs to be solved completely bottom up, or it, you know, things need to be taken, you know, more or less almost completely top down. Not completely, but with a huge emphasis on one or the other. And here these guys are saying, you know what, it's got to keep moving back and forth. So there's this role for big organizations and there's this role for government, but it's also about free markets and it's also about entrepreneurs. And above all, it seems to be that it's about technology. It's about putting putting kind of the empowerment that technology can provide over and above ideas about whether top down or bottom up is a better approach. To me, that's a refreshing break with some of the categories that we typically encounter. Which did you think, if it veered one way more than the other, was it more towards the bottom up or more towards the top down, do you think?
I think a lot of the it was top down, but it was I think it's skewed more toward top down just because they don't have enough of the bottom-up movement there yet. Mm-hmm. They have plans for it, you know, like they have Dean Kamen's U.S. First thing where you're trying to get, you know, he has like thousands of students involved in, you know, making robots and other things, which is great going. But that, you know, that's not what the other people are doing. So a lot of the other people are trying to, you know, push things out top down, but they're trying to engage. And figure out how to, you know, make it more social media savvy and you know, like use the modern tools to get broader social engagement to happen. But then they're not necessarily firm plans rolling out of it. Like at Singularity University, you know, that first year they had, you know, four startups come out of it, and, you know, some of them got funded kind of thing. Of course, with the people in the technology thing, you know, they could, any one of them, you know, they're always the VC, they're funding companies all the time, you know, they're having already an influence there, so doing another startup, another thing wouldn't necessarily do it. So it's not clear how they would, you know, get together and then make something happen, other than, you know, Bill Gates talking, you know, convincing other billionaires to donate half their money or some large portion of their money, and he's actually convinced a lot of them to do that. So then he's magnifying his existing, him and Warren Buffett's $100 billion, wherever it is, up another few hundred billion over the next few years. So you have this different scale of work happening, and then they're trying to partner with NGOs. And one of the interesting talks was by one founders of Facebook. So actually, a relatively young guy, probably like 30 years old, something like that, who talked about how he was going to create a Facebook for non-government organizations, for, you know, the big charities and that kind of thing, and try and use a Facebook-like mechanism to help them engage with each other and to be more effective, more productive, and to do that thing. And because, of course, the fact that he was involved in launching Facebook, he's totally credible when he says that, right? And he also has the meetings and he's, you know, bringing in the NGOs and doing that kind of thing. So they're trying to reinvigorate a lot of the old-style charities, a lot of the old-style NGOs, and because they have huge money and influence and access to technology, they can, you know, step up and just, you know, get the meetings and to bring that stuff together.
Yeah, well, so I think it's an excellent point that a founder of Facebook, who says he wants to take on a major social networking, social media project has a certain cachet, a certain credibility that most of us would not, right? I mean, that's just that's just the bottom line. And I love what you said about Bill Gates rounding up the other billionaires. See, that's the perfect combination of bottom down and top up, bottom up and top down. Right here, you got a grassroots movement among billionaires. That's got to be a completely new thing in the world. So, very very interesting.
Well, the thing is, like, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, one thing I make of that is that, you know, when I look at what Bill Gates is doing, you know, it's very admirable and that kind of thing, but it is focused more on the main, more traditional, with a twist, you know, trying to be more effective at it. You know, he is trying to do something a bit different with it in terms of helping, you know, cure malaria and do many good things to help save current lives. But he's not, like, taking a 5% of that money and doing a DARPA kind of thing, where, you know, you have, you know, your mainstream investment in, say, military technology, and then you have 5% going to DARPA to go for the home runs for the really big changing thing. And Bill Gates doesn't seem to have that kind of pure 5% home run, you know, like they say, like I said, he, you know, with the stuff he has, he could fully fund SENS, right? The Aubrey de Grey's
negligible senescence.
Yeah. Yeah, he could fully fund that, right? And that would, I think, have more impact, you know, over the long term, especially for the developed world, than some of the stuff that he's doing, which is great. But, you know, with all, if you've got $100 billion and got $3 billion, then I think 5%, you know, some percent should go to the big, a broad-reaching, you know, leapfrogging, you know, huge, you know, super game changer kind of things. You know, like he's going for his, you know, putting some money towards a new nuclear fission reactor for you know, that traveling wave reactor to do deep burn. So he's doing some stuff, but there is, you know, another fraction that I think should be going towards some potentially other, you know, other big big projects.
Right.
But you just a general comment. But
no, I think the point's very well taken. The point's very well made that we have DARPA. We don't need another DARPA, right? I mean, that if you can
yeah.
push if you can push out some work in some different directions, if you get people doing things that looking into things that haven't been looked into before, it's that diversity of options, and it's exploring multiple different approaches that ultimately really powerful. I don't know. What do you think, Stephen? If you had a billion of Bill Gates' money to spend, where would you put it?
Well, I think, you know, Brian's exactly right. I think that, you know, I don't want to be – I get down on Bill Gates because, obviously, his Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has done some absolutely fantastic work. But I think, you know, there's something to be said for blue sky projects that nobody else will take on because, you know, the chances are, you know, the chances are relatively low that it'll see fruition. But if it does, then it changes the world. So, you know, why not take on something like that? And so, yeah, you know, some of these billionaires that they're bringing into they're challenging to give away half their money. Maybe put a little bit towards SENS or maybe or some of these other things that could change the world. You know, so.
Well, absolutely. We had a piece just yesterday about I don't know if you saw this story, Brian. It was in Popular Science about using RNA interference to shut off protein synthesis in cancer.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So you've been tracking with that. Well, that's a great story, but the real headline there is that, oh, by the way, if this technique works, there's no reason why it can't work for every kind of cancer. And then they start listing all the other diseases that it might potentially work for, too. To me, that's interesting for a couple of reasons. One, it's interesting because it's not the immediate direction that we were expecting the cure for cancer to come from, right? If we're following completely conventional thinking, we think, gene therapy and DNA and all that kind of stuff. No, not DNA, RNA. We're just we're gonna take this back door in. We're gonna shut the protein down, and we're going to as I said, you know, from the military standpoint, we're not engaging the enemy 1-to-1. We've sent in special ops, and we're gonna starve them out. Basically, it appears to be working, and it might work for other forms of cancer. Well, you know, that'd be a great thing to put a billion in. Hey, let's see how many kinds of forms of cancer this would actually address. You know, when you see so many opportunities for moving ahead in so many areas, maybe it's more a matter of having the discretion to figure out which ones are the best bets.
I just want to throw out another one. Ben Gertz will help him out with an AI project or something. You know, I mean, there's like you say, there's just so many different places that you could look.
Okay, well, Stephen, I think you've thought long and hard about how to spend some of Bill Gates' billions. So,
I think so.
Those are both good answers.
I want to be a billionaire so freaking bad.
So, Brian. Any major things that caught your eye at the conference? Aha moments or stuff that was particularly impactful for you?
Let's see. I liked Dean Kamen's talk. Although it was him and John Dewar. John Dewar being a Kleiner, I think Kleiner Perkins. Talking buyers, big venture capitalists and stuff, and so they were trying to list down, the top problems and gauge everyone. They were having during dinner where they were front, but trying to write down ideas on a board and trying to list down solutions and stuff. But then probably the meat of that was still Dean Kamen talking about his U.S. first thing to get students engaged with technology and engineering and robotics. And then, and getting that to a large program. He wanted that to be basically like, softball or a sports team for every high school kind of thing. He wanted that to be, a robotics team for every actually high school and even down to grade school. So that was, I hadn't been as aware of, how much he'd done with that program. So that was interesting to learn. It was also good to meet. There were 10 students who won the Intel Science competition, and I were but one of them who was her last name was De Benedictis, and she wrote up a software program to help robotically navigate the gravity manifolds of You have, your Lagrange point where gravity balances out between, say, the Earth, Moon, and Sun, a kind of area where there's no gravity. And there are, if you look at all the different planets and the Sun and all that stuff, there's all these three-body problems where, basically, if you follow it all along, there's this low-energy path, say, from, one of the Lagrange points out over to Mars. Right. Mm-hmm. And basically, there's a highway where basically you use very little energy, very little fuel, and navigate around the solar system. So she made some software to identify where those points were, and if you had an ion drive, something made it to it, then you could have these robotic things go anywhere in the solar system by using this low gravity manifold system. And she also has NASA, and she's just starting a university. I think she's going to go to Caltech.
Amazing. It's,
She wrote that in grade 12.
Might well one day be deployed. I mean, that sounds like an actual practical solution to a problem of doing stuff in space. That's really cool.
Excellent.
Right. And there were 9 other presentations like that the students had. One was about growing things on the roofs of buildings to help reduce the temperature of the building inside, but you have some stuff going on top. Something called, I think it's green leaves, something like that. Another one, another guy did a design of a a nuclear train. But if he took like a submarine reactor and adapted to running a train and of course with the whole regulatory thing in the United States, it's unlikely to get up in that state. But it was an interesting effort. I think it was using existing technology because it was heavier than if you there's some stuff coming online that would make it a lot lighter and more efficient. But I think probably he was using stuff that could actually, you know, already in deployment as opposed to spending a few years to develop something more efficient and better. But anyway, so he had an idea for that, and then some other very interesting student presentations. There was a Vision 2050 from the World Economic Forum where they have a list of technology pathways and identifying checkpoints of kind of working backwards. It wasn't a prediction as opposed to here's where we want to be in 2050, say in terms of CO2 emissions and other things, and then working back from that, from a good point on those things, what do we have to do in order to be okay? Like, say, we only want 2 degrees of warming, how do we achieve that and work backwards? If we want to have no one starving and no one having water problems, you know, by 2050, then where do we have to be in 2020, 2030, et cetera, in order to get to those goals? So that was an interesting
That sounds like a really good analysis to do. Immediately, I wonder how linear that analysis would be, right? I mean, because you hear these, like, UN-type projections on those kinds of issues. They always kind of assume, you know, a pretty tunnel-visioned way of looking at those particular problems. And the odd thing is it turns out that the solution to 2 degrees of warming and the how not to have anybody starve and, you know, three other things might all be related to if you built a nuclear train, right, or something like, you know what I mean? It's like the unexpected connections between things and the unexpected breakthroughs. We were reading about just the other day this oil, something from nanomedicine being used to find oil or something. It's just these like weird leaps that can be made. Was there much of that kind of thinking that went into that analysis, or did it seem more?
They brought together a lot of business people and technologists and scientists and stuff like that to put this together, and it was again not something saying here's the optimal best way and here's how we leverage a bunch of stuff. It's kind of like if we kind of grind forward along the kind of path that we're going, what's the where the minimum effort we have to be, and if we if I mean delayed, how does that affect? So they have stuff like, you know, like nuclear powered commercial shipping and stuff like that. They put marks in it for 2040. That could happen earlier. So if things happen earlier, good things could happen earlier. Then that would relieve stress and pressure somewhere else.
Right.
But it was anything, here's this roadmap, here's a set of things, and we did look at, you know, wide-ranging stuff, although they didn't look at, you know, the singularity in terms of, like, nanotechnology or a breakthrough in AI. They didn't look at those kind of things, because basically those would be super game-changers, and then you could toss the rest of it away, right? So they're looking at, you know...
I guess it is pretty hard to address those individual problems if because in the chat room, Sally was asking... Yeah, well, will 2050 be before or after the singularity? It's kind of like all bets are off if that happens, right? So,
So they're assuming that stuff doesn't happen.
Yeah.
If it does happen, you know, great or bad, we don't know. But they're kind of like at a more, you know, if we make our planes twice as efficient, if we make our cars twice as efficient, if we do these kind of things, you know, the basic steady progress incremental stuff, here's where we need to be at. If we raise CAFE standards, this and that. You know, like, so they're talking about using the standard, what we pretty much have now and could do now if we had the will, and here's how we lay it out and map that forward. But, you know, some new ideas like, you know, nuclear power for shipping or some stuff like genetically modified foods, you know, like they have some stuff in there with certain technological, if we have to push forward ahead, we can't just stay totally static. We have to continue the green revolution and do some stuff. So they're using pretty much mundane things. But once you have this large projection, then you can take that and then you can start making your assumptions. You can, like an open source plan, you can then make your own adjustments. And then use the work to have to know here's how a broad picture rolled forward would look, and then proceed from there.
Right. Before I lose the thought, I just want to point out that DC in the chat room mentioned that Bill Gates should invest in a Caribbean broadcast center for fast forward radio. Thoughts on the feasibility there, guys? I think that's a great idea.
Next time I meet him, I will tell him.
Let him know. Oh, did you get to meet Bill Gates in person? Up close and personal?
I was in the same hallway with him, along with, a hundred of people. So, that was pretty close. I was close physically. But, it's interesting. You have other billionaires there, guys with $20 million, not poor guys. But Bill shows up, it's the thing started Wednesday, and he comes in Thursday night because he's going to talk on Friday. And then, he's still, the rock star going down the hallway. All the people wanted to talk to him. He was calling up the hallway because, there were so many people surrounding him kind of thing. So it's kind of interesting. And yet Larry Page, one-third or half as much money and plenty powerful and whatever, he doesn't get bothered walking down the hall. So that's it's kind funny. Of interesting to see that dynamic.
That's an interesting dynamic, absolutely. Yeah, the pecking order amongst the billionaires. Relative importance of billionaires. Once you get a bunch of them into a room. Well, one of the things speaking of the big names behind this, one of the names that I was really interested to see as a major force behind this is Bill Joy, who we talk about primarily as Mr. Buzzkill with his why the future doesn't need us and why all this technology is going to be our undoing, but it sounds like he's got another spin on technology that his whole view isn't bad news, apparently.
Yeah, I think he's may be still concerned about the same things, but I think he's trying to take a proactive view of things and look at how to practically solve them with technology and business, because he's a VC now. He's working, in funding mostly, I think, energy stuff in venture capital, and I think which a lot of VCs he's with, Draper Fisher or the Kleiner Perkins, I think it's Kleiner Perkins. Mm-hmm. And so he's, looking at, business plans, entrepreneurial solutions all the time. How he's, clearly he's trying to use, an entrepreneurial get engineering approach to encourage more of this technological can-do.
Yeah, to keep the world from ending, right? That seems to be a big a big priority of his. And then it's interesting. It seems to be spun out in different language now here for the tech economy. Now, one of the questions that came up earlier, and I meant to ask you this. It seems like we have an affirmative answer to the question, but I'll just ask it flat out. Would you say that techonomy is a movement?
They're trying to create it as a movement. I don't think it's there yet per se. Clearly have a lot of powerful, wealthy, top business people, like all the C-level people, a lot of people bought into it, at least saying they bought into it. So there, it has some momentum there, but, it clearly hasn't, haven't... It's not like a Tea Party, It's not like they've got millions of people, going at this thing. So they have that as a goal, but I don't think they're there yet.
Yeah, I think Tea Party is a good example because there seems to be, and I don't want to get in an argument with anyone about this, but this is my own observation, a very bottom up kind of a phenomenon, and that's what something like techonomy or really any of these. Any of these movements need to be in order to work is they have to have that bottom up component. It feels to me like coming back to that dichotomy between the two. It seems to me that the world we live in is a very top down place, except for the fact that it changes bottom up. To the extent that change occurs, it seems like that always comes from the bottom up. Maybe that's why those two things have to happen together, and that's probably why it's a good thing that they seem to be kind of talking back and forth between the two in their philosophy. Well, it sounds like it was a terrific event. Do you think you'll go back, or are they doing it again annually, or what's the plans going on?
Yeah, they're doing it annually. I'm hoping to be invited back again, and they're also doing international ones. I think they're doing one in Asia, and then I would assume Europe, but definitely in Asia. I know that they're putting one together. I haven't got the details of that. I presume probably Shanghai or someplace like that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they're definitely putting another, more of these events together. But I'm not sure how they could achieve any kind of like a Tea Party thing, because Tea Party also was harnessing anger, and as opposed to, concern. You have, the environmental movement that's based on certain fears and concerns and some aspect of problem solving. I'm trying to think of a movement that was.
I think you're right. I think a big thing. Popular movement generally occurs in response to. It's usually a defensive, reactive kind of, wow, we've really got to make something happen here, as opposed to a, hey, we've got a great idea for great things to do kind of thing, right? I mean, you get some of that, but maybe it's not as visceral. People don't get quite as turned on to it. I don't know. Stephen, can you think of any examples of, like, just totally positive, bottom-up popular movements that have occurred?
No, I guess unless, of course, you just open up the definition of what we're kind of talking about, because I mean, basically, the free market every single day is addressing some issue that might be important to just a few, just a few people, and so all of a sudden it goes to work to fill a niche . The world at large may not have any clue as to that this is being done, but we end up being the beneficiaries of it. And so, I don't think you can really call that a movement, though.
It's more like the long tail, right? It's like this big payoff we get from the
I'm in agreement with you. I think that most of the movements that you see that are political movements are reactionary. I mean, by God, this is going wrong, and we got to do something to set it right.
We got to do something to set it right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's our advice, I guess, back to Techonomy. They need to get a little more pissed off.
Yeah.
Want to push this thing forward.
Not really. We're sick of the caveman days. By God.
We're sick of all this. Okay. So anyway, good stuff. Keep us posted if you make it to any more of those. We'd like to. We'd like to hear about more of that. We've got a few other things we wanted to get into this evening. Stephen, did you want to talk about your question about thorium?
Absolutely. I saw an article earlier this week, Brian, and I pointed you to it in an email to you earlier this week, and it's basically the idea was this, that thorium is a plentiful nuclear fuel. It's very attractive in the sense that it's also makes a very poor weapons grade fuel. So there's no real issue with nuclear proliferation. The reactor designs that they're coming up with basically eats its own radioactive waste, and also if you have a standard uranium based nuclear power plant, you could ship its nuclear waste to the thorium reactor, and it can eat that too, and we have it everywhere. And in fact, it's if you're a coal miner, you chunk it out of the way as junk. You've got so much of it, and yet a fistful of the stuff could light London for a week. And so basically, the idea is this: if we really were interested in solving our energy problems, we could do a Manhattan Project with thorium reactors, and I guess my question to you is, you know, am I missing some of the things that make this attractive? Also, if we really were to pour resources into it, I mean, are we looking at something that's closer term than, say, you know, a fusion, which always seems to be 20 and 30 years away? What's your thoughts on thorium? Is it an attractive way to go?
I think, yes, it is an attractive way to go. I would also say that there are fusion projects that are not the International Tokamak Fusion Project, which or the laser project that the National Fusion Facility is going after, which are more near-term. The Buthered fusion, the initial electrostatic fusion, where you're trying to create this cloud of electrons that then sucks in ions and create fusion there, that could prove initial commercial feasibility, you know, in 2 years, and then that could be developed by before 2020, you know, by 2018, something like that. And then there's
Excuse me for interrupting, but just clarify. The thorium would be fission, not fusion, right?
Right. Thorium would be fission. Okay, so I'm going to talk about that one. So there are several thorium reactor proposals out there. The one that you saw in the Telegraph is something put forward by Nobel Prize winner Carlos Rubin, which his patents were bought by Aker Solutions of Norway. Aker Solutions does, you know, utility and other stuff. It's a pretty big company. So they need to raise about 100 million pounds, so about $100 million, to do the next phase of $2 billion, $3 billion project to develop it's a subcritical accelerator-driven thorium fission reactor. So subcritical means that the reaction itself never reaches criticality, doesn't kind of cannot go out of control, and, you know, a cascading kind of effect, because you always need, in this case, an accelerator, particle accelerator, dumping in the extra energy to kind of tip it over from 99% there to 100% there. So then it can continue the reaction. And it can also achieve complete burn-up of the nuclear fuel. They've done some detailed cost studies of this thing. I think Ruby has had this idea and with detailed academic work on it for at least 15 years, might have been longer. And they did a detailed cost analysis, and they think it'd be half the cost of a light water reactor. So that's about 2 cents per kilowatt hour.
So here we've got thorium potentially giving us nuclear power twice as much for our dollar, basically. Now switching over to some of these other ideas, the fusion processes you were talking about, where would they fall on that scale in terms of how far along are they and what return would they bring us?
So the inertial electrostatic fusion, the Buthered fusion idea, you know, if you're to push and say, okay, here's the $3 billion or here's the $1 billion to help realize the first version of each one of these things, I think, you know, there would still be scientific work to be done. And so I have difficulty seeing any of them getting done before, you know, 2016, 2015. You know, you'd have to be fairly prompt. The money would have to fall into their lap, you know, pretty much tomorrow, and they have to really start, you know, scaling up and pushing forward as fast as they could with it. A Manhattan project or something where you're dumping in, you know, $50 billion and trying to, you know, do everything you can, mobilize and, you know, turn everything upside down, you know, basically command economy and say, okay, this plant, which was making aircraft carriers, no longer doing that, we're making this thing, you know, hijacking resources, then I guess you could do it in 3 years. But I don't see that happening. I don't see, you know, any kind of Manhattan project going off on this. You know, they talk about it, but I don't see it happening. I don't see the will being there to do it. I think the fastest development, if it was to happen, would be in China, just because China is building stuff, you know, every day. You know, they, you know, like the Bay Bridge, you know, they're fixing that, you know,
right,
taking 20 years, whatever to do. China is starting up a bridge, which is about, you know, 5 times, 10 times as long. And, you know, they're going to do it for, you know, I think a little less than the cost that the Bay Bridge retrofit is going to do, and they're probably going to get done sooner. You know, probably get done 5 years, something like that. So, and then for nuclear reactors, China's got 26 being built right now. They're getting built within 5 years. The U.S. has taken 5 years to create the amount of paperwork before they decide to even pull the trigger on one. So the fact that China's building stuff, big systems every day, suggests that they could do it faster. And they're building regulator light wire reactors. They're building pebble bed reactors. One that's they're going to try and get done by 2013, which would be about 200 megawatt electricity and would be something that you might be able to fit onto to rail, or at least you could put onto a ship and move that around. Mobile, you could entire thing built in a factory, and then you would be 500 tons or 1,000 tons whatever. But you build it to move it with a big machine. You can move that thing, and they would build them in massive factories. Something that, a square mile factory, but you would be able to knock it out and say, initially the first one is talking about building in what, 4 years. And then getting it down to like 2 years, maybe even 1 year. So if you do that kind of thing of incremental improvement, of taking your reactors, which have 300 modules, some the size of a desk, some the size, a 500-ton component, like a six-story building, and then steadily bringing that down, say, okay, on the 10th one, we get it down to 4 years. On the 30th one, we get it down to 3 years. Bringing those down, those years down, means that you don't have to have a loan out for that long. And so you don't get any energy out until you're done. If I have to have a $2 billion loan to make it happen, I'm going to have to do it for 3 years. That brings the interest charges way down. And then if I can incrementally improve the lifespan of it from 60 years and say, okay, I can fully replace the pieces inside and basically rebuild the reactor chamber as well, then you can extend it out to 80 years, 100 years, and even longer. And those things also bring the cost down because you're amortizing your construction over that period. So there's the Big Bang Manhattan Project approach for, 10 different proposals in the United States. But if they're saying, okay, and then we get it done, in 2020, 2030, China, meanwhile, says, okay, and we build 10 more reactors this year, another 10 reactors this year, and we keep improving each one as we go, and then they may... They'll likely get to the same point and say, okay, we've swapped out the generator for a Brayton generator, which Brayton turbine, which is 6% efficient, but the first one we make is a regular turbine, and we switch out the component on the 20th one. And then by the 100th one, which they also make in 2020, they, and the thing is, they're guaranteed, because each year they're completing 10 of them, and then they're, each one's getting better and better. So, do you trust the guy who makes the DeLorean in 10 years, or do you trust Toyota, who's making a million cars every year, or 10 million cars every year? So if that kind of steady, constant work and also constantly building things, that is, I think, all the studies that the U.S. is doing, great, but then you start making stuff and also not saying, okay, we have to have this perfect thing down the road. It's like, make what you can make now and work towards that. Because there's plenty of, 1,000 bad coal plants, which you can replace the coal burner and leave the turbine there and swap that out with a nuclear generator. And you're saving, there was a recent study that said California is losing 9,200 lives, between 10,000 and 11,000, but 9,200 being the average. 9,200 lives to particulates from diesel and coal every year. And, of course, you have more in the United States, across the United States, but just California alone.
Right.
So,
sure. One state, right? I mean, a big state, but still, that's a lot of people.
Right.
That's a great model. I mean, I like that idea of, what if we just started swapping out those coal burners with nuclear, and the nuclear technology is being developed. Granted, it's not being developed here. It sounds like it's being pushed a lot harder elsewhere, but I see in the comments people talking about we're being strangled by our bureaucracy, and we could hope another country might shame us into progressing. But it seems to me another possibility here is that ultimately we just end up buying nuclear technology turnkey from China. right? I mean, they're going to be the ones who develop.
Yeah.
It'll be like we bought cars from Japan, right? We'll just ultimately we'll import our energy infrastructure from the people who are building new energy infrastructure, since we don't seem to be able to do it. Although, as we've learned from the early 70s on, energy seems to be the thing that drives the world economy. So if you're not on top of that, how dominant your position as a player in the world economy certainly comes into question.
Well, I certainly believe that the U.S. can turn it around. Yes, you know, China has a momentum now, but, you know, just like you had the Hindu rate of growth for a long time, saying they couldn't get over 4%, 5%, now they're at 8%, the U.S. can turn around. Just a matter of having that crisis and having the will to break up the bureaucracy, that it can happen. We just, you know, at this point have trouble visualizing it, but I think it can happen. And, you know, like the grassroots movement with, you know, like U.S. First, you know, you can get the mindsets to change to believe that it can happen. And getting people thinking more in an engineering way, but it doesn't happen right. Like even at, you know, dogmatic thinking, you know, at technology, like there was McKinsey guy who was leading an idea about revamping cities. And they have this smart city in Korea, Songdo, which is a $35 billion city with their, you know, planned city that they're building over there. And it, Cisco was saying that they're getting about 30% more energy efficiency out of that. But there was a rejection of the idea of revamping dome cities, which I was suggesting, that because it was an idea from the 50s and 60s, much like jetpacks and that kind of thing, they people have a reaction of, it's a retro future, didn't happen, it can't happen.
What is a retro future that didn't happen?
Dome city.
Oh, dome cities, okay.
Dome city.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Because if you dome a city, the benefit is that you can get 90% or even more reduction in the heating and cooling of it, because you can scale up those processes to have air exchange across this whole, you know, several square mile area.
Right.
And do that and then control the temperature. And the proof of that is that in Kazakhstan, they had this $400 million complex with this EFTE Teflon tent structure covering about 300 meters in diameter, so about 1,000 feet. And it had a seven-story building underneath it. So basically something with seven stories tall, this, you know, several football stadiums underneath it for entertainment and other things. But the temperature stays constant from about, I think, 45, 50 degrees Fahrenheit up to about 90, when it goes from negative 20 up to 110. So that temperature stays constant, so you can reduce the cooling, the, you know, making the heating and cooling far more efficient. But when I suggest this idea to it, and they're saying, you know, why do it? Well, you can achieve, you know, three times better energy efficiency than even this $35 billion city, and there's the technology is there to do it. And the first suggestion of how to get the first one going is to make it an Epcot. Because the first one costs $20 billion, you could try and find a way to make it go cheap, but if you make one that, you know, just scale things up and just assume it has to cost $20 billion, and then you figure out how to get more revenue out of it, like Epcot has, you know, tens of millions of people, tourists coming to it, this 1 mile, 2 mile diameter dome city would have massive tourism. It would be a massive tourism spot. And so then you could get your $2 billion per year of revenue to amortize the thing up, and you have a massive proof of concept. You'd be scaling up and moving forward. The materials are better now than they were in the 1950s. That EFTE, which is the strongest Teflon, can support 400 times its weight. So you can make very large things that could do it. And if you, there's a company called Temcor, which builds 7,000 industrial domes about 1,000 feet across out of aluminum. And what they do is they make a tower in the center, and then they have the dome working on the ground, and they slowly raise it up, and you keep working on the ground. So your circle goes farther and farther out as you make each level, and then you raise it up another 10 feet, work on the next level, another 10 feet, work on the next level. So you always work on the ground. So it's very safe, very cheap.
We're completely out of time, but I love ending on the notion that the dome cities are the way to go. That's
right.
That is a cool idea, and we're going to have to talk more about that. The time has just flown by. It's always great having you on the program. Thanks for being with us tonight, and we'll try to get you back on again soon. I want to explore the Dome Cities idea a little bit further. Well, I'm running the switchboard tonight, so I can tell you that our music is we're once again listening to John Boswell presenting Carl Sagan and Stephen Hawking singing A Glorious Dawn. Thanks for being with us. We'll be back next week at the usual time. Until then, live to see it.
I'm not very good at singing songs, but here's a try.
Recently we've waned a little way up, and the water seems inviting.